This is Richard Roth, and that was Armin Donnellian performing I'll Never Know Your True Worth from Syat Nova, Songs of My Ancestors, which is part of the program at the Hudson Jazz Festival, February 16 through 18 at the Hudson Hall. After the interview, I call Lalanine. This is Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC, and I am here with Armin Donnellian, the pianist, the jazz musician. Does that cover it?
Well, I would say also a composer, because I've spent quite a bit of time composing and creating my own material. Educator. I've been teaching for 32 years in the New School Jazz and Contemporary Music program in New York City. I'm an author. I've written 3 books on music instruction, ear training, and piano. I'm in the process of working on a 4th book of music that's been arranged from melodies created by an 18th century Armenian troubadour named Syat Nova. And his music, in fact, is the basis for the concert that I'm going to give in the upcoming Hudson Jazz Festival on February 16th at Hudson Hall in Hudson, New York. And there's also the basis for my album called Syat Nova, Songs of My Ancestors, on Sunnyside Records. That was released in 2013. And it's a dual CD. One CD is solo piano. The other CD is with my trio, with David Clark and George Schuller on drums. And then I guess you could say I'm also a producer, because I produced many of my own albums. And sometime band leader when I get gigs that pay enough so they can afford to hire other musicians to play with me. I do a lot of solo piano, but it's not just for financial or practical reasons, because I love to play the piano. I've been playing since I was about 5 or 6 years old. And I was trained in classical music from a pretty young age, and I got into jazz when I was around 12 years old. So that came a little bit later down the pike.
What made it appeal to you?
Well, my oldest brother played clarinet in a Dixieland band that was led by a gentleman named Arthur Ryerson, who was a guitarist and arranger and had played himself with Louis Armstrong and Jack Teagarden and Paul Whiteman and a number of other people in the 30s and 40s. And his children were my peers, growing up in grade school and high school. And you may have heard of Allie Ryerson, the flutist, who lives in the Hudson Valley. Allie and I were schoolmates, and I played with her and her brothers in this band that was led by their father. And it was because of Mr. Ryerson that I had the temerity to even attempt to become a jazz musician. But I learned so much about swing feel and syncopation and repertoire and improvisation and playing in an ensemble with other musicians in a jazz context. And it was because of that experience that I decided to become a jazz musician.
Now, to tell the truth, I have never really understood how jazz is produced. You don't start with a strict score, do you?
Well, we often start with a melody and a harmonic framework that accompanies that melody, much as you'd find in, one of the songs of the American Songbook by Gershwin or Cole Porter or Rodgers and Hammerstein and so on. And then they take that framework, which is often a set form, like what we call an AABA form, or it could be a blues form, which is a 12-bar form, and then repeat that form over and over again, but improvise over that harmonic framework. So yes, we do start with a kind of a given roadmap, if you will, But then what we do with that roadmap is really up to us as improvisers. And I know it sounds strange to someone who's not involved with improvisation, but we're improvising all the time, whether we know it or not, as we speak, because, we've studied a language, be it English, our home language, or some other language. And we use grammar, we use vocabulary, we use all kinds of vocal nuances as we speak. Playing music is much the same way, that there's a grammar to it, there's a structure, there's a framework to it, which must be learned. But the goal is then as an improviser is to use that for self-expression. Much like we don't get up in the morning and rehearse the words that we're going to say throughout the day, which would be really ridiculous, jazz musicians don't get up and rehearse the same notes that we're going to play that evening. And in fact, we could probably not even play the same notes if we tried. Because, you know, every moment of experience is different. You know, we're always in the present playing and improvising.
And there's enough of a structure to it that members of a trio can follow each other.
Oh, yes. In fact, I've had the experience where I travel to Europe and I'm booked to play with a bassist and a drummer in such and such a city. And we may have emailed each other and said, okay, well, this is the set list. We're going to play, you know, Autumn Leaves and all the things you are, you know, in this tempo or in that key and so on. Then we just walk into the club and we start playing. And because we know the frameworks already, we know the tunes. We've been playing them all our lives. But what's new is then the chemistry of the interpersonal interaction that happens on the bandstand with that particular player. And that brings a freshness and a life that is unique for each performance.
Well, for example, I saw on YouTube there's a Swiss, I think the piece is called Morning.
Morning Mood.
Morning Mood.
Right.
And you're with a drummer and a stand-up bass. So had you met those guys before? Or?
Yes, I had. I actually played with them for a few years before that. I had been going to Switzerland for a number of years annually in the spring to do an academic exchange. And then as a result of that, I was booking a few club gigs while I was there. And these particular musicians that you mentioned were my trio partners during those visits. And that one particular visit was videotaped. And that's what you saw.
Everybody certainly seemed to be having a good time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we had a great time. Because we had been playing before, as I mentioned, and you know, the music was flowing.
Now the Hudson Jazz Festival. This is the first year for that?
Yes, it is. It's the inaugural year. I was approached actually by the Hudson Opera House. The outgoing director, Gary Shiro, who, by the way, has done an enormous job of renovation of that hall. It was in a shambles. And he oversaw all the drawings and the interactions with the construction people and all the legalities. And he did a really heavy lift. And for 20 years, he was really, that was his project. And he approached me about this festival. And I was like, curated jazz festival? Are you kidding? I've never done anything like that. But the more I thought about it, the more excited I got about it. And I started meeting in committee with the staff at the Hudson Opera House and going over the details. And one by one, we put it together.
And the other musicians are also from the area?
No, they're from all over. Well, I'll just go down the lineup. The opening concert features myself playing solo piano and a gentleman named Ara Dinkjian, who is an Armenian oud player. It's a Middle Eastern instrument. Yeah, it looks like a lute, but it has no frets. So on the oud, you're able to play the in-between notes, all the Arabic and Middle Eastern scales that have quarter tones and so on. And Ara is a master at this instrument. His father is a well-known singer named Onik Dinkjian, who's been singing for some 70 years or so. He's now almost 90. And I met Ara some years ago, and I joined his band, and we had a 10-year run with his band, and it was an amazing experience. And I learned quite a bit about Armenian and other kinds of music through him. So he'll be playing on the first night. On the second day of the concert, there's a piano summit with musicians. Oh, by the way, Ara is from New Jersey. But originally, his background's Armenian, and I think he was born in France, if I'm not mistaken. Saturday, Piano Summit, we'll have Joanne Brackeen, who's a pianist living in New York area. She's an NEA jazz master or jazz mistress. I'm not sure how she wants to be addressed. But anyway, she's been called the Picasso of the piano by Marion McPartland. And on the same concert, a young man named Aaron Goldberg, who's been making quite a name for himself. He's now in his 40s, I would imagine. And then a younger jazz pianist, James Francis, in his 20s. And so as I was selecting these artists, I was trying to, find a generational spread. I was trying to make it diverse in terms of inclusiveness and trying to spread out the musical styles, between generations. They all live in New York, and they're coming up that day from the New York area. And then on the evening concert, we'll have another NEA jazz master. Her name is Sheila Jordan, and she's well known to the jazz fans in this area. She lives in Cobleskill. She's coming down for that. And also another vocalist named Dominique Eade, who's a composer as well as a vocalist. And she teaches at the New England Conservatory in Boston, and she's coming over for that. And I'll accompany Dominique, and Sheila will be accompanied by her bassist, Cameron Brown. And then on Sunday, we're going to have the third or fourth concert. Now, what was it? One, two, three, fourth concert with a man named Richard Boukas, who lives in New York City. He's of Greek parentage, but he's been involved with Brazilian music all his life. And he speaks Portuguese, and he's been to Brazil many, many times to do musicological research and study with Brazilian musicians down there. And he has a quartet that he's bringing in with saxophone, bass, and drums. And then there's also going to be a film showing on Saturday afternoon in between the piano summit and the vocal concert. A film produced by a woman named Stephanie Castillo. And the film is about Thomas Chapin, a great alto saxophonist with whom I played in the 90s and who was on his way, his career was on a trajectory to becoming, I would say, a world star. But his life was cut short, tragically, by leukemia. And he was only 40 years old. And in addition to playing saxophone, he also was a master of the flute. And that was his first instrument. It's a great movie, too. It shows all about his life, his upbringing, his experiences playing with the Lionel Hampton Band as the musical director, and then starting his own trio and playing in the downtown scene at the Knitting Factory and other places. And so that's going to be the film is free, by the way. So if anybody wants to just come see the film, it's free. And then on Sunday morning, before the Brazilian concert, there's also going to be a jazz workshop taught by myself and Mark Momas. He's this great tenor saxophonist, lives in the New York area. And Mark and I have been teaching the Hudson Jazz Workshop. We're now going into our 12th year. And we started a nonprofit called Hudson Jazz Works some years ago to support the workshop. And we'll be offering, again for free, a workshop for musicians of any age. I mean, basically from middle school age on upward. And so if anyone listening is interested in attending the workshop and learning a little bit more about jazz performance, they can go to hudsonhall.org, and there's a sign-up page on the Jazz Festival page where they can register for the workshop.
Now, for something like that, people bring an instrument?
Yes, they'd have to bring their own instrument, yeah. There will be a drum set there for anyone who plays drums. But other than that, they need to bring their own instrument.
I heard the acoustics are pretty good in that hall.
They're quite good, yes. Well, it was a speaker's hall. And in fact, Susan B. Anthony spoke there, and many other people would come on their tour circuit, as they're making their speeches, and they would speak there, and that was its original purpose. And then it was used also as a meeting hall. And then at some point, it was a bank. In fact, on the downstairs level, there's a huge vault that's still there. They did a beautiful job renovating the details of the hall, but the acoustics are quite nice. Yeah, I really like the hall.
Now, how did you happen to come to this area?
Well, I had traveled through Columbia County in years past on my way to Kripalu Yoga Center, on my way to Lenox. And I always admired the topography and the rolling hills and, you know, the view of the mountains and so on. And then many years later, I met a woman who is now my wife. And she was the mother of a student of mine who is now my son-in-law. And he is also a jazz pianist. His name is David Caldwell Mason, and my wife's name is Rose Caldwell. And Rose and I met, and, you know, after some years of dating, we decided, hey, you know, we want to be together. And at the time, I was living in suburban New Jersey, and she was living in Ghent, New York. So it was like, well, do you want to move to New Jersey? And she was going, no. And I said, well, okay, I'll move up here. And I had been living in the New York area for some, let's see, probably 25 years. I moved there in 1968 to attend Columbia University. And I just decided, oh, I'm going to relocate. I'll pack it in. I'm going to start a new life. And
Now, do you still teach at the new school?
I do.
So do you keep a place in the city?
No, I don't. I live here full time. I commute down on train once a week, and I stay over at a friend's place on Wednesday nights. I teach two back-to-back days, and then the rest of the time I'm up here. I'm involved with the workshop. I'm involved with Hudson Opera House. I do gigs in the area and regionally. I travel to Boston and still go down to New Jersey and New York to play, to Europe. In fact, I have a few gigs coming up in March. I'll be playing in Hillsdale at the Rojan Library, and then also in Red Hook. There's a library down there where they have a jazz series once a month. I'll have an announcement about that on my website, and people could go to armindonellian.com. And then I'll be playing at the Mount in Lenox in July, and then at the Ossining Public Library next year, and in between a few other things too. So,
do all these places have a piano for you?
Not always, but I really try to minimize the number of engagements that I do with a keyboard. I have a beautiful piano, actually, at the Rojan Library and also the Ossining Public Library.
Yeah. So on occasion, you will play on an electronic keyboard?
If I have to, you know. What it comes down to is, who am I playing with? Can I play what I want to play? And are the people going to listen? And how much it pays, what instrument I'm playing on, those are kind of variables that I weigh. And I think all musicians have to weigh today. It's the days of, well, there's a piano in the club, we don't have to worry about it, are pretty much over, you know, because of the expense of maintaining not only the piano itself, but the overhead, the rent, the utility bills.
How long have electronic keyboards been around?
Well, since the Hammond organ, you know, at least.
Oh, right.
You know, that was the first electronic instrument that I played on as a youngster when I was accompanying in the St. Stephen's Church in Armonk, New York, you know, for the choir. And then eventually that was actually replaced with a small pipe organ. But the Hammond was the kind of cutting-edge electronic instrument. And then the Wurlitzer keyboard came out after that, and then many other companies, Korg and Yamaha and the Casios came along. And the Casios were actually at the beginning kind of, you know, you find them in ShopRite, you know. You know, three-octave things, you
right,
know, you sell them,
right.
You know, for you buy for a Christmas present or for your youngster or something, but Casios come a long way. They've all come a long way, I mean, the quality, and not only the sound quality, but the touch. It's the main thing for a pianist is you want the touch to kind of emulate the acoustic piano. Well, you know, my father was an electrical engineer, and he would fix our television when it broke when we were kids. He was like one of these people could look at a schematic diagram and know exactly what was going on. But he bought me my first guitar amplifier, which was a Fender Showman, which is a great amp. Then after that, I got my first keyboard, which was a Fender Rhodes electric piano, which I loved. But those keyboards were it's so heavy to carry around, but that was impractical.
So you actually, the guitar preceded the piano?
No, it was simultaneous, I would say. Because as a youngster, I had the older brother who played clarinet. My next brother, the second of the three brothers, I was the third, he played guitar. And as a result, then I got into the guitar and eventually bought and played my own guitar. And then my sister, who was younger than me, also played guitar. And she has a beautiful, lovely voice. And she did a vocal degree at Harper College in Binghamton. So we were quite musical in our family and we traded instruments. I'd sometimes play on the guitar, they'd go and play on the piano. My sister also, besides singing, also played the flute. I played a little flute. I played a little clarinet. I played some drum set when I got a little older. I played the soprano saxophone. I played the organ in church. I played a little electric bass. And I accompanied for the choir. So I was involved in pretty much every musical activity in our school when I was a youngster, you know. I mean, we had an old broken down piano in our basement home, you know, and in the basement of our home. That's where I started playing the piano. And I would just, like, go down there when I was 6 years old and start riffing on stuff, you know, and playing by ear. And that was my first musical experience. It was really improvisation was my first experience. And then from that, I learned how to read. And it took
so you started taking piano lessons from someone?
Yeah, from the local music teacher who taught in the elementary school. And after a year, she recommended instruction at the Westchester Conservatory in White Plains. So my parents started taking me there for piano lessons, and I studied there for 12 years. And I got a very rigorous and thorough classical training, which I would say that was what gave me the confidence to even attempt to become a professional musician, you know. That and working with Mr. Ryerson, you know, learning how to play jazz.
And then you went to Columbia, you said.
Yes, at Columbia, and I studied music there, yeah. Reason being that I wanted to be in New York City. I have to say, before I went to Columbia, in addition to all these other music activities as a child, my father had a collection of Middle Eastern records, and he would be playing Armenian, Turkish, Greek, Arabic kind of sounding records, and that was also in the mix along with classical and jazz. And while I didn't immediately become schooled in those styles, it planted a seed that later on gave rise to my interest in Armenian music and the music that I'm going to play at the Hudson Opera House. Mostly it's music that's played through oral transmission. Most of the music is not written down. And the performance practice among musicians is to transmit things orally. There is a system, however, that I've seen for writing down quarter tones in Turkish music. And it's quite elaborate. I mean, whereas in Western music, the whole tone is divided into two parts, a half tone. I'll give you an example. Here's a whole step. And then we break that up into two parts. Right? Well, in Turkish music, they break up that whole step into nine parts. So each half step is composed of four and a half parts, if you want. And it's an amazing sensitivity to the division of the musical scale. And you'll find that in Turkey, they sing or play one way. If they go to the Arabic countries, it's a little bit different there. If you go to, you know, further east, you know, Afghanistan, India, you know, it's a whole different system there. And parts of Africa, North Africa, Tunisia, you know, it's a different take. Each country has its kind of own flavor and interpretation of these scales. And in Armenian music, it's actually, Armenians look towards the West, even though they're halfway between the West and the East. Armenia was on the Silk Road between Europe and Asia.
Azerbaijan, somewhere up in that area.
Exactly, yeah, in the Caucasus. Its neighbors are Georgia on one side, Azerbaijan on the other. Yeah, and then Turkey to the south, Iran, and then to the north, Russia. So people from all directions were coming through, much like Poland, you know, where they had the Germans on one side and the Russians on the other, and those two countries are always fighting each other and crossing over Poland, and poor Poland, you know, it just got trampled. Same thing with Armenia. You know, it was always receiving visitors. But because of that, it developed a very kind of rich connection to the East and to the West. You know, the more I learn about my, you know, cultural heritage, the more amazed I am that, I'm even born here. You know, I often ask myself, why do I have an IAN on the end of my name? You know, IAN is what all Armenian names end with, Danelian, Sarkisian, my mother.
Yeah, I lived in a neighborhood. We had Sarjanians.
Exactly. Yeah. So we all come from somewhere, you know. We're still connected in some way. And so the older I get, the more appreciative I am of those roots. I remember we would go on high holidays to New York City to the Armenian church service there, and they would burn the incense, and it was a very exotic and strange kind of experience for me as a youngster growing up in, you know, suburban New York. You know, all my friends were Jewish and Italian and Irish and so on, and I had a hard time fitting in. I didn't know where I belonged, you know. And it was only until many years later that I really started to make peace and with my background and really come into my own understanding of my true identity. Not that I'm ethnocentric, because I love everyone. I mean, I love all the richness of the world that we live in, but it's important to not demean or denigrate one's own, you know, background. And I think as a child, I had a difficult time understanding that. You know, it was a real struggle for me. I was ashamed in some way. At the conservatory in White Plains, we studied Bach, Beethoven, Chopin, all the many, many great composers. And I gave recitals twice a year at the conservatory. I gave a graduation recital when I graduated from high school. It was a Bach Prelude and Fugue. It was a Beethoven sonata. It was three Chopin etudes. It was a piece by Debussy called Gardens in the Rain, Jardin sous la Pluie. And it was a Prokofiev piano sonata. And I was also accompanying for chamber groups at the conservatory. And my father would take me to hear classical concerts and jazz concerts as well. I heard Marion McPartland play and Bobby Short as a teenager. And then, of course, my brother, and I played with the Ryerson Band. So I had quite a rich musical experience. But the classical was very much part of my life, you know, for many, many years. And I still love classical music. After college, I studied with a pianist named Richie Bayrak. And Richie, like myself, had a strong classical background. But he grew up in Brooklyn, so he's a little bit more street smart than I was, and had seen a lot more real-life jazz performances. And so I learned a lot by studying with him. And he also had attended the Manhattan School of Music and was interested in contemporary classical music and Bartok and Stravinsky and Berg and Schoenberg and all these other composers. And so he gave me a lot of suggestions for records and scores that I should get and listen to. After studying with Richie, then I felt prepared, and I very kind of serendipitously was asked to audition for the band led by Mongo Santa Maria. And Mongo was an Afro-Cuban percussionist from Havana who had emigrated to first to Mexico and then to the United States, and he had started a Latin jazz band. And
a big popular hit.
Yes, he had a big hit, yes, called Watermelon Man. And that was all over the radio when I was a kid. And he also wrote a tune called Afro Blue that was made famous by John Coltrane, the great tenor saxophonist. At any rate, I auditioned for Mongo's band, and I was accepted. And 2 weeks later, I was like in a recording studio recording Afro-Cuban music, and I'd never played a note of Afro-Cuban music in my life. And it was really fast learning experience. But then subsequent to that, we did many tours to the West Coast and up and down the East Coast, Canada, Puerto Rico, St. Croix, and other places. And so in those on-the-road experiences, I learned how to play Afro-Cuban music. And it was like graduate school for rhythmic training.
How many pieces in the band?
8. Yes, it was piano, bass, drum set. Mongo played the congas. There was a conga player. Bongo player. Who played also cowbell and what we call auxiliary percussion, clave, submaracas. And the drum set player also would double on timbales, which is a kind of a large stand-up drum. And then there was tenor saxophone, the tenor saxophone also doubled on soprano. Then there was the alto saxophonist, doubled on baritone, and then there was a trumpet player. So 3 horns, piano, full rhythm section. And it was quite a lot to deal with. And it really taught me how to listen.
Now, how old were you at that point?
I was 25.
So you were probably one of the younger members of the band.
There were a few others that were my age, but most of them were older.
And then later on, you worked with Sonny Rollins?
Yes, a few years later. After Mongo, I worked with Mongo from 75 to 77, and then I had a couple of years off when I worked freelanced. I had some gigs with Lionel Hampton and Ray Barreto. And then I got the gig with Sonny, and I worked with Sonny for about a year, from 1977 to 78. And that was another life-altering experience, because Sonny is just such a powerful and imaginative improviser. And we toured mostly in the U.S. I didn't go to Europe with Sonny, but nonetheless, what working with Sonny did for me was to help me really come out of myself and be able to solo for long periods at a time. With Mongo's band, the solos were, compartmentalized. And with 8 people in the band, everybody can't take, 10-minute solos. But with Sonny, it was quintet. Saxophone, guitar, piano, and then bass and drums. So I was a featured soloist. And we played for large audiences at major venues. It was quite a responsibility. And then after Sonny, I worked with Billy Harper, who's also an amazing tenor saxophone player. And with Billy, I, again, was called upon to take long solos and imaginative solos. And we toured all over Europe and Japan and received a great deal of exposure by working with Billy. And I learned a lot personally as well by working with him. And there's a long list of people. I don't want to bore you with them, but I've just been so fortunate to work with so many great people.
An album now. Do you do it on vinyl?
No. It's pretty much all digital. I mean, people are producing vinyl albums now. I can't say that there's much commercial viability in that medium. Some people think there is. I know there are collectors who only buy vinyl. But nowadays, streaming is really where it's at. I record usually for the Sunnyside label. Sunnyside is in New York, and I've known the owner for many, many years, for decades actually, since 1986. His name is Francois Alacan. He's French. He's very dedicated to jazz music, and he's very open and has very, open tastes. He's been a big supporter of my music ever since he heard me play, and for that I have to feel very grateful. And he's honest, which for the record business is...
stands out, maybe.
It does, yeah. But I think more and more musicians today are starting their own labels or doing short runs of maybe 300 or 500 CDs and then selling them on gigs. The days of getting distribution deals all over and selling CDs in stores and so on. I don't know. I think that's all gone by the wayside.
Yeah, I've heard musicians really have to keep touring. And
yeah. It's point of sales that really generate the CD income. When you do a concert, after the concert, right away, try to sell the CDs at the door there, as people are going out the door.
Right. Well, that's when you're interested in the music. I mean,
yeah.
That's when you want them.
Yeah. But then there is a lot of, like you said, there's online income to be made as well. I mean, people maybe afterwards recall, oh, yeah, I like that piece that Armin played. Let me go and check out online what he did. And then they look at that, and then maybe look at something else that I did, and maybe decide to download something. You know, I've been supporting myself more through teaching in recent years than through CD sales. I enjoy teaching. I've always enjoyed teaching. I've been doing that since I was 14, actually. But in recent years, since around 1986, I've felt that with teaching, I have more of a direct communication with the recipient of my musical offerings. And I feel a sense of fulfillment to that connection that I don't always get when I'm performing. Certainly when I perform, people applaud, they express their appreciation and gratitude and whatever. But then the event is over, they walk out the door, they go home, and there I'm alone, you know, left with the memory of that experience. And it's a very sweet memory. But with teaching, I get to interact on a daily basis or a weekly basis with my students, and I get to discuss the details of the music and work on the, you know, how the music is performed, what's entailed in bringing out the aspects, the characteristics of the music. And I find that I can share a lot more with my students. And in that way, I feel like I'm contributing to changing the history of the musical world in a way that I don't when I perform. That when I teach, I'm actually doing something concrete. When I perform, I'm also doing something concrete, but its effect is not as much for the performers of music, but as for the listeners of music. And of course, they are important to me as well. I mean, because they're my audience, they support what I do. But I enjoy teaching, and not all musicians do. I can say I'm fortunate for that. You know, I feel blessed. It's become something that feeds me spiritually as well as puts, you know, bread and butter on the table. So yeah, that's a big part of the pie.
Now, is there anything else you'd like to talk about?
Well, I don't know. I so rarely get a chance to talk about myself that when people ask me, I'm a little bit shy, you know. I just have to say my parents were so supportive of me when I was a child, developing my musical abilities, and that I've had such great teachers. My classical teacher was a man named Michael Pollan, who was an emigre, born in Austria, trained in Berlin, and then emigrated here in 1939. He was Jewish, and he came to escape from the impending Holocaust. He taught me so much about music in a way that was rigorous and demanding, but without being demeaning or humiliating. That it was a kind of a tendency among a lot of these people of that era. He was a very kind and generous man. So I learned so much from him about how to play classical music, and that filtered over into my jazz playing. On the other hand, I was very fortunate to work with Mr. Ryerson, as I mentioned, and his family, his kids, Art Jr., Rich, and John, as well as Allie, because they embody the spirit of jazz in the way they played music, and that infected me with the jazz germ. And then, as I mentioned, there were three people that really made a big difference to me in Armenian music. And this came a little bit later on in my mid-20s and early 30s. The first person was a musician named Suren Baronyan. He is a clarinet player, saxophone player. He grew up in Spanish Harlem, playing both Armenian music and jazz. And he studied with Lenny Tristano, who was a rigorous teacher, and became a devotee of the music of Charlie Parker and Lester Young, Warren Marsh, and, you know, the people of the Lee Konitz and all the people of the kind of Lenny Tristano school of playing. And when I heard him first play, he was playing with a band called Taksim. Taksim is an Arabic word meaning improvisation. And in Taksim, Suren combines the music of the Middle East with Charlie Parker jazz. And he composed his own tunes and developed his own style that was really unique. First time I heard him play, I was like, what? You know, it's like, because he was playing all those Middle Eastern scales, you know, but with a jazz beat. So I got to meet him, I listened to him, we got to work together, and we actually made one record together. And through him, then I met another musician named Ara Dingchan, who I mentioned is the oud player that's going to be on the festival. And I got to play together, and working with him in his band, Night Ark, we toured in 5 countries and made 3 records together. And he taught me even more about Armenian music and its performance. And then subsequent to that experience, in 1990, I met a woman named Datavik Hovhannessian. Datavik is a vocalist who originated in Armenia. And when the perestroika happened in the Soviet Union, and, you know, the whole Soviet system came crashing down, she came to the United States looking for a better life for her musical arts, because she was already quite famous as a jazz vocalist in Armenia. And her mother was renowned as a singer of Armenian folk music. So Datavik, who had listened to Ella Fitzgerald and Sarah Vaughan and all the great jazz vocalists of the United States while she was living in Armenia, also had this background of Armenian folk music. And she brought that with her. And she came, I met her, we started working together and rehearsing and developing our own kind of style of Armenian jazz, and developed a repertoire together and playing gigs and festivals here in California and Maine and Philadelphia and other places in Boston. And then we were heard by a man named George Avakian. And George was a legendary record producer who produced albums of Louis Armstrong and Keith Jarrett, and he was a producer for Columbia Records for many, many years. And he heard us and he took an interest in our music. And through my work with Datavik, then our work became more widely known. And so with these three musicians, Suren, Ara, and Datavik, I connected more with my Armenian musical roots. And it was because of that that I think that I had the courage, you know, to go further with it. And then in 2002, well, back up a little bit, in 1998, I took my first trip to Armenia to perform and teach there in the Yerevan Jazz Festival. And this was in collaboration with Datavik and Ara. And during that period, I did some workshops at the Yerevan Conservatory. And then they asked me to come back, but they suggested, hey, you know, Fulbright has a program where you could get money to support a residency here, you know. So I looked into that and I applied for a Fulbright grant. And as a result of that, I applied and I got it. And I returned in 2002 as a Fulbright scholar. And I stayed in Armenia for a whole semester. And not only did I teach, but I also studied. And I studied the culture and the history and the music of Armenia. And I came across a book of songs, a very rare book that was out of print since 1946, of the songs of Sayat Nova, this composer that I had mentioned earlier. Tsayanova was an 18th century troubadour and poet of the first order. And his poems have been compared to Shakespeare, and his melodies rival Chopin's. I mean, they're just beautiful melodies. And hearing his music and then playing them from this songbook that I obtained, I began to appreciate them more and then became interested in developing my own kind of approach to them. And so I started arranging them and playing them on gigs, and over a period of about 12 years, reworking and, you know, restudying. And then finally the music got to a point where I felt ready to record it. And that's the basis of my album, Songs for My Ancestors, that came out on Sunnyside Records. And this is the music that I'm going to be performing at Hudson Hall on February 16th. So it's kind of a long road for me, and it's a very organic process, and I never really knew where I was going half the time, but somehow, you know, putting one foot in front of the other, I just happened to follow the right path. But I'm indebted to all my teachers and mentors and the people that supported me along the way and, you know, made it possible for me to do what I do. And then finally, I have to just mention my wife, Rose, who's been a big supporter of my music since we've met. And she encouraged me to undertake this Armenian CD project. And so thanks go to her as well. Now, that's all I really need to say.
Thank you very much for being on the show.
It's my pleasure, Richard. Thank you for having me.